listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
President Donald Trump and his Democratic Party opposition in Congress went to the airwaves Tuesday night to talk about the wall and government shutdown. The exchange began with this from the president.
My fellow Americans, tonight I am speaking to you because there is a growing humanitarian and security crisis at our southern border. Every day, customs and border patrol agents encounter thousands of illegal immigrants trying to enter our country. We are out of space to hold them, and we have no way to promptly return them back home to their country. America proudly welcomes millions of lawful immigrants who enrich our society and contribute to our nation. But all Americans are hurt by uncontrolled illegal migration. It strains public resources and drives down jobs and wages. Among those hardest hit are African Americans and Hispanic Americans. Our southern border is a pipeline for vast quantities of illegal drugs, including meth, heroin, cocaine, and fentanyl. Every week, 300 of our citizens are killed by heroin alone, 90% of which floods across from our southern border. More Americans will die from drugs this year than were killed in the entire Vietnam War. In the last 2 years, ICE officers made 266,000 arrests of aliens with criminal records, including those charged or convicted of 100,000 assaults, 30,000 sex crimes, and 4,000 violent killings. Over the years, thousands of Americans have been brutally killed by those who illegally entered our country, and thousands more lives will be lost if we don't act right now. This is a humanitarian crisis, a crisis of the heart, and a crisis of the soul. Last month, 20,000 migrant children were illegally brought into the United States, a dramatic increase. These children are used as human pawns by vicious coyotes and ruthless gangs. One in three women are sexually assaulted on the dangerous trek up through Mexico. Women and children are the biggest victims by far of our broken system. This is the tragic reality of illegal immigration on our southern border. This is the cycle of human suffering that I am determined to end. My administration has presented Congress with a detailed proposal to secure the border and stop the criminal gangs, drug smugglers, and human traffickers. It's a tremendous problem. Our proposal was developed by law enforcement professionals and border agents at the Department of Homeland Security. These are the resources they have requested to properly perform their mission and keep America safe. In fact, safer than ever before. The proposal from Homeland Security includes cutting-edge technology for detecting drugs, weapons, illegal contraband, and many other things. We have requested more agents, immigration judges, and bed space to process the sharp rise in unlawful migration fueled by our very strong economy. Our plan also contains an urgent request for humanitarian assistance and medical support. Furthermore, we have asked Congress to close border security loopholes so that illegal immigrant children can be safely and humanely returned back home. Finally, as part of an overall approach to border security, law enforcement professionals have requested $5.7 billion for a physical barrier. At the request of Democrats, it will be a steel barrier rather than a concrete wall. This barrier is absolutely critical to border security. It's also what our professionals at the border want and need. This is just common sense. The border wall would very quickly pay for itself. The cost of illegal drugs exceeds $500 billion a year, vastly more than the $5.7 billion we have requested from Congress. The wall will also be paid for indirectly by the great new trade deal we have made with Mexico. Senator Chuck Schumer, who you will be hearing from later tonight, has repeatedly supported a physical barrier in the past, along with many other Democrats. They changed their mind only after I was elected president. Democrats in Congress have refused to acknowledge the crisis. And they have refused to provide our brave border agents with the tools they desperately need to protect our families and our nation. The federal government remains shut down for one reason and one reason only, because Democrats will not fund border security. My administration is doing everything in our power to help those impacted by the situation. But the only solution is for Democrats to pass a spending bill that defends our borders and reopens the government. This situation could be solved in a 45-minute meeting. I have invited congressional leadership to the White House tomorrow to get this done. Hopefully, we can rise above partisan politics in order to support national security. Some have suggested a barrier is immoral. Then why do wealthy politicians build walls, fences, and gates around their homes? They don't build walls because they hate the people on the outside, but because they love the people on the inside. The only thing that is immoral is the politicians to do nothing and continue to allow more innocent people to be so horribly victimized. America's heart broke the day after Christmas when a young police officer in California was savagely murdered in cold blood by an illegal alien who just came across the border. The life of an American hero was stolen by someone who had no right to be in our country. Day after day, precious lives are cut short by those who have violated our borders. In California, an Air Force veteran was raped, murdered, and beaten to death with a hammer by an illegal alien with a long criminal history. In Georgia, an illegal alien was recently charged with murder for killing, beheading, and dismembering his neighbor. In Maryland, MS-13 gang members who arrived in the United States as unaccompanied minors were arrested and charged last year after viciously stabbing and beating a 16-year-old girl. Over the last several years, I've met with dozens of families whose loved ones were stolen by illegal immigration. I've held the hands of the weeping mothers and embraced the grief-stricken fathers. So sad, so terrible. I will never forget the pain in their eyes, the tremble in their voices, and the sadness gripping their souls. How much more American blood must we shed before Congress does its job? For those who refuse to compromise in the name of border security, I would ask, imagine if it was your child, your husband, or your wife, whose life was so cruelly shattered and totally broken. To every member of Congress, pass a bill that ends this crisis. To every citizen, call Congress and tell them to finally, after all of these decades, secure our border. This is a choice between right and wrong, justice and injustice. This is about whether we fulfill our sacred duty to the American citizens we serve. When I took the oath of office, I swore to protect our country, and that is what I will always do. So help me God. Thank you and good night.
The Democratic Party leaders from both houses of Congress gave a reply, beginning with this from Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Good evening. I appreciate the opportunity to speak directly to the American people tonight about how we can end this shutdown and meet the needs of the American people. Sadly, much of what we heard from President Trump throughout this senseless shutdown has been full of misinformation and even malice. The president has chosen fear. We want to start with the facts. The fact is, on the very first day of this Congress, House Democrats passed Senate Republican legislation to reopen government and fund smart, effective border security solutions. But the president is rejecting these bipartisan bills which would reopen government over his obsession with forcing American taxpayers to waste billions of dollars on an expensive and ineffective wall, a wall he always promised Mexico would pay for. The fact is, President Trump has chosen to hold hostage critical services for the health, safety, and well-being of the American people and withhold the paychecks of 800,000 innocent workers across the nation, many of them veterans. He promised to keep government shut down for months or years, no matter whom it hurts. That's just plain wrong. The fact is, we all agree we need to secure our borders while honoring our values. We can build the infrastructure and roads at our ports of entry. We can install new technology to scan cars and trucks for drugs coming into our nation. We can hire the personnel we need to facilitate trade and immigration at the border. We can fund more innovation to detect unauthorized crossings. The fact is, the women and children at the border are not a security threat. They are a humanitarian challenge, a challenge that President Trump's own cruel and counterproductive policies have only deepened. And the fact is, President Trump must stop holding the American people hostage, must stop manufacturing a crisis, and must reopen the government. Thank you. Leader Schumer.
Thank you, Speaker Pelosi. My fellow Americans, we address you tonight for one reason only. The President of the United States having failed to get Mexico to pay for his ineffective, unnecessary border wall, and unable to convince the Congress or the American people to foot the bill, has shut down the government. American democracy doesn't work that way. We don't govern by temper tantrum. No president should pound the table and demand he gets his way, or else the government shuts down, hurting millions of Americans who are treated as leverage. Tonight, and throughout this debate, and throughout his presidency, President Trump has appealed to fear, not facts, division, not unity. Make no mistake, Democrats and the president both want stronger border security. However, we sharply disagree with the president about the most effective way to do it. So, how do we untangle this mess? Well, there's an obvious solution. Separate the shutdown from arguments over border security. There is bipartisan legislation supported by Democrats and Republicans to reopen government while allowing debate over border security to continue. There is no excuse for hurting millions of Americans over a policy difference. Federal workers are about to miss a paycheck. Some families can't get a mortgage to buy a new home. Farmers and small businesses won't get loans they desperately need. Most presidents have used Oval Office addresses for noble purposes. This president just used the backdrop of the Oval Office to manufacture a crisis, stoke fear, and divert attention from the turmoil in his administration. My fellow Americans, there is no challenge so great that our nation cannot rise to meet it. We can reopen the government and continue to work through disagreements over policy. We can secure our border without an ineffective, expensive wall. And we can welcome legal immigrants and refugees without compromising safety and security. The symbol of America should be the Statue of Liberty, not a 30-foot wall. So our suggestion is a simple one. Mr. President, reopen the government and we can work to resolve our differences over border security, but end this shutdown now. Thank you.
There was good news recently for imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. BlackAgendaReport.com's Glenn Ford spoke with Professor Johanna Fernandez to discuss a possible way home for the imprisoned journalist.
Supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal are ecstatic over a Philadelphia judge's decision that could allow the nation's best-known political prisoner another chance to appeal his conviction in the death of a police officer 37 years ago. We asked Professor Johanna Fernandez of the campaign to bring Mumia home if there's finally a real pathway to freedom for Abu-Jamal.
We do indeed, and this is, again, unprecedented because the courts, year after year, have refused to hear arguments on the unconstitutionality and violations of conduct by the prosecutor, the judge, and the police in the original conviction trial of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And now for the first time, a judge in Philadelphia, in the Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas, has said that there in fact was bias, judicial bias, in the review of a series of appellate hearings that Mumia requested in the 1990s. So this is really groundbreaking opening in this case that I think if we win will strike a blow to white supremacy in this country, because Mumia's case has been heralded by the Fraternal Order of Police and by politicians as the major law and order case of this contemporary moment in American history. And they've used the case to essentially galvanize and strengthen the criminal justice system.
Now, what the Superior Court judge, Leon Tucker, ruled was that there was an appearance of bias because the former prosecutor, Ronald Castile, who went on to become a Supreme Court judge, then was allowed to sit in on the deliberations over Mumia's previous appeals. Now, Castile won't be allowed to sit in on any future appeals, but you're going up against the same Supreme Court without him. Why are the prospects better?
Well, I think the prospects are better for the same reason that this law and order judge, Leon Tucker, ruled in favor of Mumia. This is a different moment in American history. Ironically, we have an arsonist in the White House, but a series of movements have in fact shifted consciousness on the ground and exposed the criminality, if you will, of the criminal justice system. So we have to thank the movement that organized around the execution of Troy Davis. I want to remind you that this is really the moment when this shift began. There was an international movement to stop the execution of Troy Davis that lost. But that name was imprinted in the minds of people of conscience in this country. That was followed by the Occupy Wall Street movement, which essentially made it okay for the first time in American history to criticize capitalism. And then there were a series of police shootings of Black people in this country that led to the Black Lives Matter movement. And that combined with the publication of Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow means that people in the mainstream today acknowledge that there is a grave problem with police brutality and mass incarceration. At the same time, we have a situation in which even conservative judges across the country understand that if we don't hold the line to essentially legitimize the criminal justice system at a time when Trump is in the White House, all legitimacy of the system will be lost. So even conservative judges are ruling in ways that they had not previously. So this is the context within which this new opportunity is presented to us. And what we need to make sure is that we continue to shift consciousness on the issues and the violations surrounding the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And we need to once again make the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal a household discussion.
Yes, I remember in the 1980s, the Philadelphia chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists, of which Mumia was a founding member, didn't want to have anything to do with him as a defendant. And yet now the NAACP is part of his defense, and Mumia's plight has become, in a sense, somewhat mainstreamed.
Right. So part of what happened in an earlier epoch, I say epoch because this case has been litigated in the court system for 37 years. So we've seen generations come and go. And at the height of the movement, Mumia was a villain in the public eye. The Fraternal Order of Police demonized him. He was the poster child of the Fraternal Order of Police, and he symbolized the reason for them, for the Fraternal Order of Police and their supporters, the reasons why the apparatus of incarceration needed to be cranked up. I don't know if you remember, but in the 1990s, Mumia was named in a mainstream newspaper a super predator by a criminologist, a well-known criminologist. He literally began an article, I think in the New York Times, identifying Mumia and the likes of Mumia as a super predator who essentially was a threat to security in the United States. But that was in the 1990s, ironically, at the height of the movement that stopped Mumia's execution. But unfortunately, the policies of the Clintons reigned supreme during that period, and the apparatus of incarceration was cranked up. But again, this is a new period, and the fact that a very mainstream organization is defending Mumia Abu-Jamal, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, these are the folks who argued Brown versus Board of Education, suggests that a new day has dawned. And Mumia, I believe, is coming home.
If the courts do entertain Mumia's appeal, what kind of issues will be reopened? Issues that people may have forgotten with time?
Well, one of the major issues that will be presented to the appellate court is that a court stenographer by the name of Terry Moore Carter overheard the judge who presided over the original case, Albert Szabo, say to another judge in the anteroom of the court, quote, "I'm going to help them fry the nigger," unquote, referring to how the judge was going to instruct the jury. Other issues include prosecutorial misconduct. So part of what happened during the trial was that the prosecutor suppressed exculpatory evidence, essentially that there was a fourth person at the crime scene. Another issue is that there was tampering with evidence on the part of the police. And I will remind your listening audience that a third of the police officers involved in Mumia's case who collected evidence within weeks of the end of Mumia's trial were convicted and jailed for corruption and tampering with evidence to obtain convictions. And this was part of a larger investigation conducted by the Department of Justice in 1979, in which the Department of Justice determined that the behavior of the police department in Philadelphia was homicidal. And I'm quoting that report and quote, what they said about the dealings of the police department in Philadelphia was that, quote, "it shocks the conscience." And so these are some of the issues that are going to be heard if the DA of Philadelphia, the progressive Larry Krasner, does not challenge the decision of Leon Tucker.
And what are the indications in terms of DA Krasner's intentions?
Maureen Faulkner, the widow of Daniel Faulkner, the police officer that Mumia is wrongfully accused of killing, was on Fox News just this weekend, essentially saying that Mumia killed her husband and she would not stop until she secures justice in this case. And she said to Fox and Friends that her people would be hearing from the DA of Philadelphia, Larry Krasner, in the next, quote, couple of days. So there is a tremendous amount of pressure placed on Larry Krasner right now by the Fraternal Order of Police. But Krasner was not elected by the Fraternal Order of Police. He was elected by the people of Philadelphia, who campaigned hard for him, and he was a candidate outside of the Democratic Party apparatus who won. This is unprecedented in the history of Philadelphia. There has been no DA in Philadelphia, either in the Democratic or Republican Party, who's been elected without the support of the Fraternal Order of Police. Larry Krasner won because the people of Philadelphia mobilized for his campaign and voted en masse. And they voted because he promised to correct the wrongs of his predecessors. And he essentially said that the prosecution's office should not be preoccupied with prosecution, but rather with justice. So we know that Larry Krasner is nationally renowned and celebrated for reforms at the local level. He has decriminalized marijuana. He has addressed the issue of police corruption and tampering with evidence. He is single-handedly responsible for freeing the hip-hop artist Meek Mill. And he even wrote a letter in support of Debbie Africa, one of the members of the Move 9 who was recently released. So the question we pose to Larry Krasner is if he's going to heed the call of Leon Tucker, who, by the way, is a law and order judge. And what he says in the decision, and I'm reading from the decision right now, is that in order for the criminal justice system to work, quote, justice must be completely just, without even a hint of partiality, lack of integrity, or impropriety, unquote. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next few weeks. In the meantime, if he appeals, this issue will wind its way through the lower courts and then the federal courts, and it will delay for sure Mumia's path to freedom.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. What is happening with Trump's decision to leave Syria? And are you ready for the 2020 presidential sweepstakes? Also, is there any integrity in the Integrity Initiative? Crosstalking some real news. I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Bobich. He is a political analyst with Sputnik International. And in Athens, we have Alex Christoforo. He is the director and writer for the Duran.com. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to you first, Mark. Staying in Syria or getting out of Syria? Because if you listen to administration officials, and I'm specifically thinking about John Bolton, the national security advisor, he's traveling in the Middle East trying to convince the region that, nah, the U.S. really isn't leaving. What's going on?
Yeah, it was never very likely that the U.S. would be pulling its troops out of Syria after, you know, everything that's happened in the last few years. Now, I think it's even less likely than before. And President John Bolton, I mean, National Security Advisor John Bolton has seemingly, whether it's through argument or running, running around Trump's announcement of a withdrawal, a complete withdrawal of U.S. troops now, has now announced that it is conditional. And he's doing this of a trip.
Yeah, but we've seen the goalposts moved before every single time. Let me go to Athens. Alex, it's just not John Bolton that seems to be dictating the narrative here, but we also have Trump's troubled relationship with the military brass here. So this is an interesting concoction, a brew here that Trump either cannot deal with or has just accepted that he's not going to be able to make this decision. We will leave Syria. I guess that's for his base. So the status quo remains, Alex.
Well, Peter, I mean, Trump ran on two very big election promises. One was the wall, and the other one was to get the U.S. out of all its military entanglements abroad, specifically Syria. He mentioned Syria a lot in 2003 in many tweets. So he ran on these things. And if he doesn't fulfill these election promises, he's going to be in big trouble in 2020. But what he's running up against, Peter, is the permanent state, the deep state, call it what you will, whether it's the generals, whether it's Lindsey Graham, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, or whether it's the mainstream media who is also urging Trump, putting all their might and all their muscle into trying to convince the American public that Trump is making a bad decision by leaving Syria. And all of a sudden, Peter, the narrative now is the Kurds. No one was talking about the Kurds for so many years, but all of a sudden, everyone is an expert on the Kurds and what's going to happen to the Kurds should Trump get out of Syria. So that's the narrative now.
Okay, Dima, but I mean, if you were to go to alternative, and I would say real media sources, the Kurds are already talking to the government in Damascus.
Not on the Twitter.
And they're talking with the Russians as well. I mean, there is an entire process to end this war, but it seems Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, the mainstream media, the deep state, they want nothing of it.
Well, the problem is that the whole narrative of the mainstream media is collapsing because for years they have been saying that Assad was a butcher, you know, the Kurds and the Arabs.
Barrel bombs,
you know, they would like anyone but not Assad, you know. And now the Kurdish militias invited the Syrian army to Manbij. On Tuesday, you know, the Russian military police came to Manbij to monitor the transfer of power there. And the kind Turks, the NATO allies, who were proclaimed anti-Assad fighters by the U.S. media and the European media back in 2011, 2012, let me remind you, when the Syrian anti-aircraft forces downed a Turkish fighter which entered the Syrian space in 2012, European press was seriously talking about a war on Syria, because Syria is an aggressor against Turkey. You know, I remember it very well.
Yeah.
Talking about this whole story with American troops leaving, not leaving, northeast of Syria, I think the best comment came from the American conservative. Andrew Bacevich wrote, Trump professes to believe in America first, while Kelly and the military stop brass belief in global leadership, which implies, among other things, gargantuan Pentagon budgets, a vast network of bases, suitably compliant allies who provide markets for American arms, and the willingness to fight very long wars. End of quote. So say goodbye to the nice story about the military being the last to want wars.
Right.
The military, you know, there are military on the ground and there are military like Mr. Mattis. And another interesting transfiguration is how Mattis, who was a mad dog, very dangerous, you know, handpicked by Trump, now he is suddenly, according to the liberal media,
canonized saint. He's a saint now.
Yeah, he's a saint. He is a benign influence on Trump. He's someone who was limiting Trump's bad instincts.
The adult in the room.
Absolutely, okay. Yes. Not the mad dog anymore.
But Mark, I mean, when we consider the media barrage of people that essentially have no idea what they're talking about, but that doesn't stop them. As Alex Christopher pointed out, most of these people had never uttered the word Kurd until the last week or so here. But considering the barrage against this in the media, public opinion, narrowly, is for it. Trump knows this. This is his political instinct. He has the right instinct on this. He doesn't know. He doesn't have the tools to get it done.
Yeah, well, I first of all, I think that too much can be made of the idea of this as some kind of Trump campaign promise. It's true he did campaign on this, but it's also true that the vast majority of Trump voters out there, with perhaps some of our fans being the exception, don't care about foreign policy. This didn't win him plaudits with the Republican base. If he had campaigned again on invading Syria with ground troops, most of his supporters probably would have gone with that as well. So I don't think he will suffer much political damage if he's seen as walking away from this.
Yeah, but what is the damage, Mark, of him saying, we're getting out of Syria, and
it doesn't happen. What does that do?
He's reversed course on so many campaign promises and policies at this point. I think most of his true hardcore supporters will simply go along with it. We can always toss up, like Bolton is doing, with defense of Israel, protecting the Kurds, getting our NATO ally Turkey to promise not to attack the Kurds, or ISIS is totally and completely and forever defeated. This is conditionality that Bolton has set out, which can be fed to the Republican base, and which is essentially impossible. If those are, it's conditionality designed specifically to ensure that the U.S. never leaves Syria.
Well, that's the ultimate goal here. Let me go back to Alex in Athens. I think there's a caveat to what Mark just said here. There is evidence that in the 2016 election, that Trump's message against nation building abroad, about exporting of democracy, and I say that in quotations, there is an element of Trump's base that anti-war, anti-empire is important to them. And I think that's one of the reasons why Trump keeps that in mind. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, you've even seen people like Warren and Ted Lieu, I believe, also came out. And these are some very unlikely voices that actually threw support behind Trump for this Syria decision, which was really out of the blue. But the whole Trump's predicament right now, Peter, is that he is going up against, and you said this many times, he's going up against empire. And everything that's happened with Trump in Russia and the Russia, you know, witch hunt and the hoax is nothing compared to what Trump's about to face if he actually does push forward with trying to disengage the U.S. from Syria and scale back on American empire. Here, I really think he's going to face a very, very dangerous obstacle, a very dangerous problem of possibly getting impeached.
Yeah,
because he's going
up
against very powerful forces. It is empire is his big problem right now. And if you couple that with the wall, and if he doesn't get the wall approved and passed and built, then he is going to really run into trouble in 2020. And I think the Democrats and I think the rhinos and the permanent state and the mainstream media know this.
You know, Dima, the fact is, it's not really about Syria at all. It's not about 2,000 troops there. They certainly haven't been using much effort to fight and destroy ISIS. They're right next to each other, okay? Almost like in peaceful coexistence here. The real issue is here is that if you make one withdrawal, then there's a logic of, well, why don't we withdraw from other places? Iraq, Afghanistan. And this is something all of these, the deep state, the media, the political leadership in both parties, that's something they can't contemplate.
Well, when the United States did not apologize to Iraq, when it did not apologize to Libya for the civil war there, when it is now not apologizing to Syria, this has one very bad consequence. The United States never makes conclusions from its own defeats. I mean, the defeat in Syria is obvious. The United Arab Emirates are returning their embassy to Damascus. Assad is going to a summit of the Arab League in Tunisia.
The Sudanese president visited Damascus.
You know, they were defeated. But instead of acknowledging, you know, this is the problem with the ideology that the United States and the EU are ruled right now. It cannot admit defeats. It can blacken a certain person, like we lost to Trump because Hillary Clinton was bad. Or, we almost lost the elections in France and Germany because Russia was spreading fake news. But they will never say that actually our ideology was wrong. Actually, our plans for Libya and for Syria were unsustainable. They will never admit it. And this is what is making future wars possible, unfortunately.
Last 10 seconds.
They don't have to, though, because they don't have to win in Syria. They can simply deny a substantial win to the Syrian government and Russia. A destabilized, chaotic Syria, as a spoiler, serves their purposes almost as well as a proxy Islamist government in Damascus.
Or said differently, keep it a quagmire. Yeah. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Athens here. Alex, this is the first time I'm going to mention the presidential sweepstakes of 2020. We got 2 years ahead of us here. We have Elizabeth Warren. She's thrown her hat into the ring. Joe Biden is publicly considering it. And up to maybe 20 other Democrats here. What I see happening over the next 2 years is a form of cannibalization and balkanization of the Democratic Party. Essentially, identity politics on acid, and it's going to be a real ride. What are your thoughts at this very, very early point, Alex?
Well, I think that Elizabeth Warren definitely likes beer. I think we saw that on Instagram. She has no understanding of social media. She has no understanding how it's used. I think she saw what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did by using social media to really propel herself into the spotlight. And in a very failed attempt to use Instagram, Warren failed tremendously. She has no chance, Peter. I think you're exactly right. We don't have a front runner right now for the Democrats. I don't think Biden can beat Trump. I think the only person that can beat Trump at this moment is Trump. And it goes back to our first segment, which is if he doesn't follow through on his campaign promises, he is going to be in trouble. At this moment in time, the only person that understands how to use the media, how to use social media, and how to suck up the oxygen from the room is AOC. She may not be right on 99% of the things that she says, but the 1% of understanding the media and getting media attention from both the left and the right, she understands that. But obviously, she is way too young to throw her hat in the ring.
You know, Dima, it seems to me the ideology, the liberal ideology in the identity politics issue is really going to cut very deep into this presidential campaign because True. Joe Biden's a white guy, okay?
Oh, yes.
And I probably have more Indian blood than Elizabeth Warren, okay? but we hear the rhetoric coming out of diversity. But at the same time, it seems to me the Democratic Party will discriminate against certain people because of their outward appearance. It's going to cave in on them, and it's going to do it this time around.
It's the problem of ultra-liberal globalist ideology. If only we replace one group of people by the other group of people, privileged by the liberals, everything will be fine, you know. They now have four women running five top U.S. defense companies, which means buying and selling weapons that kill hundreds of thousands of people around the world. And this is a huge achievement for women, according to the Democrats, right? Now they can fly jet fighters and bombers, killing as many people as men in a second. And this is, again, a huge achievement. I don't think it's an achievement. You know, if American women had the same rights for example, childcare, like sending your baby to a kindergarten, as the women here in Russia, that would be a victory. But the identity policy is not talking about childcare. They're talking about women heading defense companies, right?
It's all about power.
And when I heard Joe Biden as the candidate from the Democrats, this is a disaster. This would be a disaster because he was the man who came to Moscow in 2010 and said that the United States wouldn't like Mr. Putin to return to the Kremlin. Who the hell was he to tell Russians whom we should return?
Well, he spent a lot of time on the Maidan also, yeah. Didn't he?
He was the main campaigner for Maidan and for the disaster that followed in the United States. He helped Poroshenko stem Ukraine in the most disastrous first 2 years, you know, when thousands of people were killed in Donbas. So this man is going to bring peace. This man is going to have a sobering effect on American foreign policy. That sounds like Mad Dog John Mattis, the only adult in the room, you know, with Donald Trump.
Okay, Marco.
I haven't heard any Democratic base calling for peace. In fact,
it's kind of flipped.
They've become the other war party. So I don't think that's a demand of Democratic candidates. I noticed that Kirsten Gillibrand has sent out exploratory feelers, and she's polling her natural constituency, meaning she is asking Wall Street executives if they're interested in backing a campaign if she ran it. So that, you know, that I think what is required for the Democrats to win, I think she demonstrates it pretty clearly. I think Yes, there will be a quite divisive and fractious Democratic campaign. We don't know if a primary campaign, Hillary Clinton will come in again, Joe Biden, you know, Elizabeth Warren, and I'm sure there will be others, maybe even Gillibrand. But if we've learned anything from the last election, that despite it becoming public that Hillary Clinton and the Democratic National Committee conspired to rig the primary.
Exactly.
They remarkably rallied then around Hillary Clinton, with even the rigged victim himself, Bernie Sanders, then coming around and backing Hillary Clinton.
Okay, so. Let me go back to Athens. Alex and Mark already mentioned Bernie Sanders here, and we do have people in Hillary Clinton's orbit saying basically Bernie Sanders supporters should shut up and nod. How does Bernie play into this early in the game?
Well, I think if Bernie didn't fold to Hillary Clinton and actually stood up for himself when he was robbed of the primary win, then I think people could still see Bernie Sanders as going up against Trump. And I think Bernie Sanders would have a shot to defeat Trump. But at this point in time, I think that a lot of millennials and a lot of the young people that did support Bernie and a lot of the progressives don't have the faith in Bernie that they once had. And I think that's the key point, Peter. You have a large portion of the population that are real progressives, that are really people that align to the left. They don't have anybody speaking for them or speaking to them. And so I think that's the void that Bernie has left, and that's the void that no one is really filling.
That's a very good point here. All right, I want to switch gears here, Mark. Let's talk about what is called the Integrity Initiative. Please explain what it is, because it has not gotten a whole lot of media coverage. Essentially, how I read it, and you can fill in the gaps here, RT, Sputnik, we are accused of manufacturing and coordinating a propaganda programs, an agenda, all through the West. But this Integrity Initiative is exactly that, against Russia. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is first of all, it's described as a charity or a NGO, non-governmental organization, considering that it is funded and actively organized by British Foreign Office staff. It's actually, you might want to call it a GONGO, a government-organized non-governmental organization, right? It's an oxymoron, and just the name itself is quite euphemistic. It is essentially a rapid reaction online troll network, of their own troll network, of many big names in not only British, but around the world, of the most Russophobic journalists, academics, think tankers, whose mission is at the direction of the British government to jump on issues, to pile on, and to put up certain narratives, information, disinformation into the media sphere, targeting not Russians,
right? Okay,
but their own people and citizens across European countries that they have meddled and interfered.
Would you say that is a form of meddling in the internal affairs of other countries?
They say it's necessary because of the threat presented by Russia and China's Confucius networks. Because if there's one thing that is a real threat to citizens of the West, other than fluoridated water, it's learning about Confucius.
Okay. Dima, my point is that we are accused of being the purveyors of propaganda, but this organization, this Integrity Initiative, that is their whole mission.
Well, somehow the hackers who basically exposed some of the documents of the Integrity Initiative, founded by the Institute for Statecraft, among other founders.
Funded by the British government.
And funded by the British government.
And smearing British politicians also.
One of these documents is about someone named Victor Madeira from this Institute for Statecraft, proposing a series of measures targeting Russia, including mass expulsion of diplomats. Back in 2015, he wrote that letter. And surprise, surprise, in 2018, more than 100 Russian diplomats were expelled from the UK, from the US, from other Western countries because of the Skripal affair.
Okay, well, these leaked documents give the impression that this initiative was forming the narrative around the Skripal
affair. Long before the Skripal affair, there were contours of this kind of reaction against Russia that followed. And again, you know, we will be having such things until we forget. Remember all the noise around the American embassy in Cuba being attacked by some very, very sophisticated sonic weapons. Now it turns out that these were actually insects.
Crickets.
These were crickets making mating sounds. And no one is paying attention. It's okay. You know, we forgot it. Probably the American diplomats will return. Probably they will have a mosquito net against them, you know. And in the same way, it may turn out that when we actually find out the truth about the Skripal affair, about it being a provocation from the UK or from some other Western intelligence services, you know, we will not know it until, you know, a small article in the Times of London, like, by the way, you know, these people were poisoned by us. Okay.
Okay, let me finish off with Alex here. I'm really glad that Dima brought up the cricket story, because this whole integrity initiative has been received essentially with crickets in Western media. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, no one is reporting on it. No one at all. But I mean, Peter, I think the main point is that all roads go back to the UK. Whether you're talking about the Steele dossier, whether you're talking about Stephen Halper or the Professor Mifsud, talking about
chemical attack
in a London, chemical attack, Papadopoulos in a London pub. These guys had a man from the UK, 20-year-old guy from London, working in the Bernie Sanders campaign. How does that happen? How does this guy from the UK, from the Integrity Initiative, end up in Iowa to work for the Bernie Sanders campaign? Let's not forget, they smeared Jill Stein as well. So, I mean, this is an incredible story that no one is reporting on.
Last 20 seconds, Mark.
Yeah, I evidently, according to the Integrity
Initiative,
I am a Kremlin troll, and they've geolocated that I post directly out of the Kremlin itself. They're really good at that. They've recommended
but
that
you've
Russian
never been
agents.
There.
I've never been even on a tour, but if they'd like to write me a letter of recommendation that they think I should be posting out of the Kremlin alongside Putin, I'd much appreciate it.
Okay, Jim, that's all the time we have for this. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow and in Athens. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.